I know what a food blogger is.
Well, this guy's a big one. And a lot of these big guys, they don't like me. They got it in for me because I got a lot of good write-ups when I started out.
They're haters.
Exactly. We didn't have that word when I was growing up. There was no word for hater. The most you would say is that somebody was, like, jealous, which didn't really capture it. Oh, the sausage guy's here. You ever try andouille sausage?
No.
It's spicy. You like spicy?
No.
It's not so spicy. Come on.
Hello.
What's happening, Broseph Rosensteel?
Ugh. Never call me that again. Jesus.
Am I the first person to ever call you that?
No. Ugh.
No, I'm not the first person to ever call you that?
No, you're not. But still, it's just terrible.
It just came to me. I thought it was kind of funny.
Okay, Bran. It's like bro plus Dan, Bran.
A Bran is a promise.
Mm-hmm. a Bran is definitely a promise that you'll see later on in a few hours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that one. Because Bran is also a food.
It's fiber.
Happy to be back in L.A.?
Yes. No. Yes.
No. Did you have a nice trip?
Yeah, I mean, in general, yes. But I'd be fine with being back in L.A. if I wasn't at work. Darn that work and its requirement that I go there.
Well, technically, it's not a requirement that you go there, especially if, you know, your boss is really down on you and won't let you cook the stuff you want to cook.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. They got upset when I wanted to change the menu, the menu.py file, as it was. Oh, that was a dumb joke.
That was a great joke, actually. I didn't think about that one.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You're like, I want to rearrange these tabs in this interface. And they're like, what are you doing? Just do your work and go home.
Yeah, I call this gizmo sweetbreads. No. anyway.
Foodtruck.gizmo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No one has any idea what we're talking about.
No.
I'm not sure I have any idea what we're talking about.
Do we in general, and you specifically, ever really have any idea what we're talking about?
Sometimes. So, you know, I occasionally write outlines when I have things to say, and then mm-hmm. I follow those outlines, and usually it works out pretty well.
Do you color within the outlines?
No, because I use a text editor with white text on a black background, so there's not really any color there. Although I guess the syntax highlighting is yellow.
Mm-hmm. No purple prose then? Get it? Because it's color?
Man, it's been so long since you were just full of puns. Like, you must have revitalized your pun reservoir while you were on vacation.
I'm drinking tea.
is that what does it for you?
Mm-hmm. Well, no, actually, I think I was just well rested, and, you know, I had a nice 8-hour day, and I you know, had some tea.
Hmm. Did you perchance have a Cuban sandwich?
No, because there are no good Cuban sandwiches in Los Angeles. You have to go to Florida. And
there's that place in Burbank that's pretty good, right?
Porto's Bakery. They are pretty good, but they are not the same as Florida. And I'll explain why specifically. Cuban bread is very specific. It is made a very specific way. And anytime you're having a Cuban sandwich, whether that is the actual Cuban sandwich or pan con lechon, the roast pork sandwich, either of those things, it requires Cuban bread. And nobody really makes Cuban bread most of the time. They just use baguette. Porto's does actually make Cuban bread, but it's not 100% as good as what you'd get in Florida. So this distinctly changes the sandwich, because a bread is mostly sandwich bread. That is in essence what it is. This isn't a wrap. You know, you can't just substitute any old floppy tortilla.
It's not 100% Cuban, so like its mom was from Nebraska or something?
No. Oh, well, the worst trend in food in L.A. about 3 to 5 years ago was that every place had a Cubano sandwich, which was their take on a Cuban sandwich, which was exceptionally bad because these were mostly white chefs that were just kind of had been to Miami one time or something, or read about what a Cuban sandwich was in the news or something. And so they would make these horrible...
Somebody described it to them over the phone?
Yeah, it would make these terrible things. And it'd be like, okay, well, there's ham, and then you have sliced pork loin, Like that is not a substitute for roast pork. You can't just like just here is a piece of dry pig. Please enjoy your sandwich. and they'd put it on like ciabatta bread. Occasionally
a dry pig sandwich sounds good.
Yeah,
dry. Oh no, you can't use ciabatta bread on a Cuban.
No. Or they'd use baguette, like I said. And it would just be a disaster. It's like this functionally is not what it is supposed to be. And they smear on like grainy mustard, incorrect mustard. I mean, there's like any place where they could go wrong, they went wrong. And one time, it was a sandwich special at this one place where I was working in Culver City. And this guy came out and he's like, oh, how do you like the sandwich? And I didn't know who the guy was other than he worked there. And I was like, well, it's not a real Cuban sandwich, but it's pretty okay. And he asked me to explain, and I explained all the things that weren't exactly the same. And he's like, well, a lot of people really like the sandwich. And I was like, okay, it's still not a Cuban sandwich. So that's just me being me, I guess. But
that's a pretty spectacular story.
Mm-hmm. But seriously.
Welcome to Hypercritical Cuban Sandwich Edition.
Mm-hmm. A whole episode about Cuban sandwiches. Do you know the difference between a Miami Cuban sandwich and a Tampa Cuban sandwich?
No.
Salami.
Which one has salami?
Tampa.
Interesting. I'm not sure I agree with that.
Okay, do you want me to explain why?
Sure.
Because there were a lot of Italian immigrants in Tampa because the Ybor Cigar Factory had started up there. They were outsourcing Cuban cigars from Cuba to Florida because it was cheaper. Think about that. And the Italian immigrants that they were hiring on were mostly there to do the art for the cigar boxes. And so there was sort of a fusion moment where they put salami inside of the Cuban sandwich in addition to all of the other ingredients. Miami does not do that.
Good to know. I think now we're officially in This American Life Cuban Sandwich Edition.
Mm-hmm. And a Cuban should always be heated and pressed, no matter where you get it from, on a plancha.
You mean a George Foreman grill?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I never had a George Foreman grill, did you?
No, I never did. I wanted one because everybody had one. Because when I went to college in, you know, the early 2000s, that was the cool thing, was that everyone had a George Foreman grill. And this is right around the time they were coming out in all those different colors. So they were also like...
I don't remember that.
Oh my God. They were in different colors and different sizes. There was like the junior size or whatever. And so like people would have all different kinds of these things, and all of the cool kids would have them, and I did not have one at all. Fortunately, I didn't actually have one because they turned out to be kind of annoying to clean, and like the little grease tray thing would frequently spill over hot grease and stuff. And so, as you can imagine, the George Foreman grill didn't really stick around. Get it? Because it's a non-stick grill. Anyway, it didn't really stick around much long after that. There's a pretty funny 30 Rock where they kind of poke fun at sort of celebrity cooking devices.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were off limits in my college, but everyone tried to use the argument because I think the rule for the dorms was written, you know, 15 years before, and it said no hot plates in your dorm room. And it's like, well, it's not a hot plate. It's a George Foreman grill. It's like, yeah, it's the same thing. Get it out of here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fire hazard. But
especially in Arizona.
Yeah, everything's a fire hazard in Arizona. Arizona is a fire hazard in Arizona. But most of the time, everybody had just like those little dinky, like 700 watt microwaves that would sort of not cook things and simultaneously burn them because the heating elements and everything were so imbalanced. So it became a technique of how to reheat certain different kinds of standardized things like Hot Pockets. Ramen. Everybody had like their own little way of doing it, and that's interesting to see how all of that panned out. Like if I was making ramen in the microwave, you'd put the ramen in a bowl and then you'd fill it up with water just to cover it. That way, it wasn't like super soupy when it came out. But then you'd only use half of the seasoning packet because otherwise, that was way too much salt. Yeah.
Oh, ramen life hacks. Yeah, the only year I was in a dorm, which it was technically an apartment complex owned by a dorm, I had a regular size microwave and I had a stove, which I promptly ruined because it was like from the 70s. And I put the wrong kind of like glass dish, well, bowl or Pyrex bowl or something on top of it. And as it cooled with my pasta in it, it just exploded into a bunch of little pieces of glass that sort of fell into the really old cooking elements.
Dan, it says on the Pyrex, do not use on the stovetop.
I swear I could have checked that one, but who knows? It was a long time ago.
Okay. And also, well, I mean, I've exploded Pyrex before, but it was in my apartment. It was a pie dish. And I forgot about the temperature difference when I put, because I can't remember what it was. I put some little thing in there just to heat it up in the oven real quick. And then I was like, oh, well, got to cool it down. And then
you just threw it in the freezer or something?
No, just a little bit of cold water.
Oh, yeah,
crack, explode.
Yeah.
So that was a good plan. I was really good in the kitchen. And I'm glad we're sharing all of these kitchen and food stories because obviously we're both still thinking about the film that we recently watched.
Yeah, we got to get everyone psyched up, get their stomachs warmed up.
Okay. which would be Chef by Jon Favreau. So I believe that's how his name is pronounced.
Yeah, that sounds right to me. Mm-hmm. 2014's Chef.
Mm-hmm.
Not to be confused with the character from South Park.
Mm-hmm. Chocolate, salty. Anyway,
no Salisbury steak in this movie that I was aware of, at least.
Yeah, but there was a chocolate lava cake. It has a molten center.
I did like that they went with the chocolate lava cake because of all of the trite desserts you could possibly pick for like a fancy restaurant. That is borderline just.
The tritiest.
Completely over. Yeah, it's done. We don't need any more of those.
Well, that was the whole point of that menu was to make the most ridiculous, outdated, like fad from 10 years ago that stuck around way too long kind of menu, which is exactly why they had all of those things on there, and why the criticism was that they were all competently executed for what they were for the most part. Except he disagreed about the lava cake. But they were mostly competently executed for what they were, except there was no creativity, no imagination, no soul to it. And of course, Favreau's character himself felt that way about the place. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'll eat the hell out of a chocolate lava cake at like a steakhouse or something. But I know what I'm going in there for. I'm going in there for a steak and a pretty boilerplate meal, not a fancy upscale best chef in the world kind of. Weird thing that you would find in LA. The lava cake is the kind of thing you find in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it was kind of weird. I didn't catch it the first time I watched the movie, but I rewatched the beginning again because I was trying to figure out the geography of where in LA this was supposed to be. And apparently the restaurant he's cooking at is in Brentwood, which kind of makes a little more sense because geographically speaking, the restaurants there are full of old people. And
along with the city itself.
Well, Brentwood's not a city. It's a neighborhood of Los Angeles.
Well, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Brentwood is the Ahwatukee of Los Angeles. It's not really a city, but it's a city. Moving on.
So
he lives in Venice, by the way, which it was a good name drop.
Yeah, well, that's where all of the pseudo-creative schmucks live, is some stupid studio apartment in Venice where they can be creative, man, and get back to their roots and connect with the people, man.
It looked like they retrofitted a garage to be his apartment in this movie.
Oh, well, you know, have you been to Venice?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a dump.
It's not that bad.
It's a dump.
It's just, it's a little bit 1970s.
No.
Like, as in they haven't done anything to the neighborhood since the 70s.
Actually, they've started gentrifying the crap out of the place, mostly around Abbot Kinney and that area.
I've been down there.
Yeah, if you go there, you can get a nice, you know, $20 hamburger and, you know, $14 beer and stuff like that. It's that sort of area now. Mm-hmm. But it has like a pseudo grassroots pseudo bohemian thing going on. So you'll walk into like a store that has like five things that they sell, and it'll be like just some gray little sack shirt or something like that, and then you'll see like 20 people walking on the street in those gray little sack shirts and stuff, and you'll be like, oh, so it's just sort of like paying a lot of money to look like you're poor. It's very strange. It is a peculiar place in the greater Los Angeles area. but I sidetracked us. We were talking about regions. And I don't know where Sofia Vergara's character of Inez is supposed to live exactly. But one would assume it's somewhere around Santa Monica or something. And then
big fancy houses with large front yards.
Yeah, well, it could be anywhere.
Could be in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Could be. But then there's the whole thing of all of the other places. They mention all of the geography, basically, that they plan on driving through at the very beginning of the movie, which sets up a lot of other stuff later on. But I got a little sidetracked. Where should we pick up here? I mean, we don't need to really like pick this apart like scene by scene, do we?
No, probably not. We can just give a basic overview of sort of what's going on. There are a lot of callbacks in this movie, so just, you know, the beginning of the movie ties into the end of the movie pretty succinctly. So let's see. We can sum this up in that Jon Favreau is the head chef at a restaurant owned by Dustin Hoffman, where he has been for quite a number of years, where they are relatively popular, but not super hip anymore. Jon Favreau is going to be reviewed by the hottest food blogger in the business,
yes.
Oliver Platt, who sold his blog to AOL for $10 million. Is that what it was?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and then I bet AOL canned them with Joystick and everybody else.
Yeah, probably. They take all the fun out of everything. And it probably was a really good food blog, too. So yeah, Jon Favreau wants to create a cool, fancy custom new menu to really impress the chef or the food critic. Dustin Hoffman is not having any of it. He wants him to stick with the menu because that's what everyone loves. And he's been making the same thing for 5 years or so, and everyone loves that, and blah, 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 blah. And he does some stupid metaphor about if you go see the Rolling Stones, you want to see him play the hits. And he tells him to play the hits, and Jon Favreau slinks back into the kitchen and agrees. And you can see he's a little defeated, but he at least agrees with the point that this is Dustin Hoffman's restaurant, and this is how he wants to run it. Even though there's this very odd dividing line about their agreement, you know, you don't come into the kitchen, I don't tell you how to run the outside of the restaurant, which if any restaurant was actually run like that, it would probably immediately fail because you have to kind of work together. So you shouldn't go into business with people who have completely different opinions of you, of what you should be doing. But I digress.
Well, I mean, but to be perfectly honest, it does seem like this dividing line is rarely ever enforced because he basically just gets bullied into doing whatever it is that Dustin Hoffman feels like he should be doing. And Dustin Hoffman even lays down several veiled threats about just firing him, you know, and having another chef afterwards. It is a very clear hierarchy of the who is employee and who is employer. He's just trying to give the semblance of control to Favreau. This facsimile, just be like, oh yeah, you're totally in control, except right now I just think you should listen to me right now. It's pretty manipulative, but it works. So
yeah, but I mean, as a restaurant owner, you can't really blame him. Like, Dustin Hoffman's not like this psychotic vindictive guy. Like, he's got a business to run, and if he thinks that's the best way to do it, he could do that. I mean, it's not his fault that he's unimaginative and he'll go out of business just because he fails to innovate or whatever they call it in the food industry. But I mean, it's his business. He can do whatever he wants. I didn't find him to be like the angry, I just want to screw with you because I'm in charge character. He was just a slightly misguided guy who was grasping at straws in terms of what it came when it came to trying to understand what made his restaurant popular. So, you know, you've got the just stick with what always works guy who runs the place, and you've got the creative artist who just wants to do what he wants to do, man, and make some awesome stuff, and they surprisingly clash until Favreau just sort of gives in, and he makes the boring menu, and he gets a terrible review because the food is unimaginative, and he takes it really personally, and he's sad about it, and he flips out and discovers social media at the same time.
The discovery of social media is quite possibly one of the more entertaining parts of this for me. I was watching this last week with my mom, who similarly does not understand Twitter. And that's actually a good thing, because if she was on Twitter, I think she would be absolutely confused by what I tweet. But the whole thing here of like, oh well, you know, I sent him a private message, and it's like, no, you didn't. It provides a certain comedy to this that is in a way believable, that he doesn't actually understand how this works, and that, you know, there have been several times that chefs have blown up on people on social media, and it has not worked out well for them. One chef in LA told me I was a liar one time on the LAist blog.
Why were you talking to a chef on the internet?
I wasn't. I was replying to somebody's thing, and I was sharing a story about how bad that restaurant was that they were reviewing, and then the chef had decided he was going to individually reply to every single person who had commented on it.
That'll work out well.
Oh man, it was a train wreck. Guy needed a publicist, is what he needed.
He should have gotten Amy Sedaris.
Yeah, should have. He could have been on with Gordon Ramsay. But I digress. So just seeing him not being able to wrap his mind around social media is quite entertaining. I could have done without the cutesy floating text bird animation things.
I thought it was pretty cool.
I did, except it was hard to read, and they the bird part was a little too cutesy.
I thought the bird part worked at the end there, when like he finally has the line outside the truck, and like they do that crane shot, and you see all the birds flying like out of the trees. I thought that was kind of clever, but the integration of the graphics was something new, so it kept it a little fresh.
Yeah, but with the bird thing, it started to feel more like a Twitter ad instead of a...
Oh, it totally did.
Yeah, it was like, hey, how much money is Twitter paying you guys? Oh, they're not paying you anything? Oh, well, good job. Well, at least they didn't come up with like a fake service or something like Sheffer or something like that. That would have been the worst.
No, but you know, he's got Twitter. He eventually signs up for Vine. They get a Facebook page. I think that's all of them, right? I didn't see any mention of Instagram.
No. But it was an interesting experience for him. As somebody who had basically ignored everything for 10 years and had only done what he was used to for 10 years. The other people around him all seem more savvy than him. Not just the son, but John Leguizamo and Bobby, I can't pronounce his last name. But anyway, the character of Tony.
Cannavale?
Yeah, Cannavale. He was on Will and Grace. They both are on Twitter and can use Twitter and can use other databases for other things. But
their description of the way adults use Twitter just made me sad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's John Leguizamo. Why shouldn't it make you sad? But
John Leguizamo was funny for a time. I don't know what he's been doing lately.
Well, he did Chef. Did
you ever see The Pest?
No, I've never seen The Pest. Did you ever see the Spawn movie?
Yes, I saw the Spawn movie. you should watch The Pest, if only for its just overt 90s absurdity.
Mm. Well, you know me. I love my 90s absurd.
It's like Ace Ventura level of ridiculous, but the basic premise is... I believe some rich old white guy wants to, who's an avid hunter, wants to find a human being to hunt because man is the toughest game. And he ends up the most dangerous game. Yeah, there you go. The most dangerous game. And he gets talked into being that, you know, he fights back. Mm-hmm. And I believe he wins because I don't think he gets shot.
Mm. Is he a real pest about it? Anyway.
I believe that is actually a shortened version of whatever his name is, but he is incredibly obnoxious, and it's kind of funny.
That's hard to believe.
I believe there's a dance-off in the street at one point. His Jeep transforms into like a giant flatbed full of stereo speakers.
Okay. Back to the movie. So it becomes a bit of an educational experience for him, trying to figure out social media and stuff like that, and his challenge to Oliver Platt to come back and re-review his restaurant now that he's going to really put out something. And this is where we get the big confrontation with Reva, and we find out exactly the limits of how nice he's willing to be to entertain Jon Favreau rather than just cut him loose. It's a well acted scene. I thought it worked out really well. He's well within his rights to do all of the things he does. He's an idiot. It's his power, his prerogative to be an idiot. Jon Favreau, goes off, and for a while we think he's going to cook all this stuff that he's cooking in the side scene, and then he's going to like take it back to the restaurant or invite Oliver Platt over or something like that and show him what real cooking is. He doesn't do anything with that food. He just cooks a bunch of
stuff. He just kind of lays it out. Like, I thought he was going to at least like take a picture of it and send it to him or something, or yeah. Just like,
he's just like hate cooking.
Yeah, I guess he's finally, this is the scene where he finally breaks free from his bonds and he's trying to do his own thing. And I guess he's just got so much pent up creativity that he just like, you know, his hands are, is furious. He's just, he can't help making all of these delicious things. And he lays them out like just end to end on this gigantic counter and just kind of looks at it. I'm not sure why. Yeah. Like, I know chefs are artistic and creative and stuff, but like, I don't think they generally make food just to like make it and be like, well, I made that. I think they usually make it if somebody's going to eat it. Even if they're just trying stuff out, they usually eat it, I think.
Especially the way it was all intercut with Oliver Platt, who's doing an excellent job of looking over his glasses.
He did an okay job in that scene where he's looking around just going like, really, guys? You're serving me literally the exact same thing I had last time?
Yeah, no, I thought it was very funny because he does a good job being a total jerk. Yeah, I really did think the way they were intercutting this that it was going to actually go somewhere with this food, that it wasn't just like,
I mean, there's a couple montages, but yeah, that one was kind of misleading.
Yeah, it was just creativity blue balls. Like, he just needed to cook all this stuff, and then once he did it, he was like, ah, done. And then he goes to the restaurant, and he's apparently talking to Scarlett Johansson over the phone, and like, keep him there. I'm in the car. I'm coming in. And it's like, oh boy. And then we get the whole lovely confrontation where there's some really choice dialogue about how not upset he is. He's just shouting,
squeezing the chocolate lava cakes and throwing them all over the place. And
yeah,
it's kind of it's a little contrived where he's like losing his mind in this public place, and he's, you know, kind of shocked the next day when it's all over the internet and there's nothing to be done about it. It's like, well, even if you're not familiar with social networking and the internet, you're probably familiar with like news cameras and how they can occasionally capture things, and those go out all over the broadcast waves and people see them. But you know, it's for the purposes of the story, everyone pulls out their phone in the restaurant when he's losing his mind, because they're all there to see this challenge, because again, it was not a private message on Twitter, it was a public message, and everyone's to see, you know, is he going to throw down with this guy when he comes back in for his second meal. And they all just take awkward video recordings of him and post it online, and all the blogs get it, and the blogs reblog the blogs and whatever the hell they say.
Yeah. And then he has a scene where he reviews it on his little tablet thing. That he goes and he talks to Amy Sedaris, who is the PR executive that Inez knows, who might be able to help him with this, but she seems only interested in promoting his sort of celebrity bad boy chef image for television. Which
again, is totally a way to go with that if you are so inclined. But Jon Favreau is a unique flower, and he's just an artist at heart, and he just wants to cook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so he's totally not down for that, because that is against his desires. Although financially, it would have made a lot of sense given his current circumstances. But it was a funny scene, and she's all like, "Yeah, so you know, just go ahead and let them know. No, don't let them know. Okay, so let them know. No, don't let them know." He has more, you know, the crisis of trying to figure out what it is that he wants and how he's not going to see his kid, and, you know, several confrontations about not taking money and stuff like that. and how they're not going to go to New Orleans like he had promised.
They kind of gloss over a lot of that stuff, like in that little bit of time, right? Because he talks about how he used to have a lot of offers from restaurants who were trying to poach him, but this internet thing is all over the place, and he's got to wait for it to die down. And then, like, it's literally the next scene where the internet thing has died down, and he has no offers, and he has no idea what to do next. Like, he's in a matter of minutes, like they've backed him into this sort of story corner where he has absolutely no other option other than to do everything himself and ask for help from everyone in his life.
Yeah. Hold on a second. I'm going to pour some tea. That was some good tea. All right.
It poured really well.
Mm-hmm. So we have this whole thing that unfolds relatively quickly, which culminates in Inez offering that when she goes to Miami for business, that he can come along and talk to her ex about a food truck, because apparently he has something to do with them. It is still sort of ambiguous what exactly she does and what exactly he does.
Yeah, they never mentioned other than the fact that she is apparently a rather high-powered executive of some sort, would be my guess, since they're always being driven around in large, expensive Mercedes-Benzes.
Yeah, although he does seem to imply that a lot of it is divorce money or something, and it's like, how much money was she really getting from you? Let's be honest about this. It seems like...
Or is the implication that it's the money from Robert Downey Jr.?
That is also another way to look at it, since several times it is looked at that he is the one with the money. The offer is made, and he's going to come along as the nanny, quote unquote, to watch after their son. It's a very peculiar arrangement. They go to Miami and they go to see her father, and he's playing a band, and they go to Versailles to eat, which is a Cuban restaurant there. And they're having their Cuban sandwiches, and he's like, I want to wake up my kid and feed him a Cuban sandwich. He's really gung-ho about this, and it's like, calm down. Calm down, dude. You can have a Cuban sandwich tomorrow. It's fine. but they go through the whole thing, and he goes to talk to Robert Downey Jr., puts on the little booties, walks into the hall and slips a couple times for comedy effect, and they have... a lovely little moment where Jon Favreau talks to Tony Stark. And there's really no other way to slice that. It is literally like, this is Tony Stark.
Did you also notice earlier when Jon Favreau goes on like an afternoon hanging out with his kid where they go like eat some food and they go see a movie that they totally go see an Iron Man movie?
Oh, I didn't catch what that was. That was just generic sound effects.
They didn't show the movie, but one of the sounds was definitely the Iron Man suit repulsor charging.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be funny. Because I have a theory, not to sidetrack us, but I have a theory that that this is largely a response to criticism that Favreau has had about his movie making, where instead of...
I would not
of,
be surprised in the least.
Yes, because where instead of being a chef, getting restaurant critics... He is perhaps a director getting film critics.
And he's being told to make the movies that they want to make. It's not necessarily his art, but when they criticize his movies, it hurts him personally, even though he had no control over the menu or the script or whatever.
Yeah. It feels like there's a lot of Iron Man 2 angst mixed up in here.
I don't know if we want to get into this now or we can wait till the end of the sort of walkthrough to talk about it, but it is my personal feeling. I don't know if you feel the same way, that there is a fair amount of this movie that is self-indulgent, that if somebody other than the director had say over the edit, a lot of it would be removed, because this is not a short movie. This is almost 2 hours long. And I find a great deal of the scenes, some of them felt improv-y. A lot of them felt like they just went on too long. And some of them felt like they were just there because they wanted to put them in the story and they really had no purpose other than just, I wanted to put this scene in the movie. Did you feel that way at all?
Yeah, although I was trying to think of some way to say it without using self-indulgence, to say that like five times whenever we talk about some director doing something.
Well, it's a different way, but yeah. It's like, you know, there were moments where I looked at this and I go, okay, the scene is okay. And it's, you know, there's some jokes in here that are kind of funny and it looks like they're riffing a little bit. And it's a good moment to keep in there. But in the name of making a movie that it should be concise and to the point of what we're actually talking about here, the scene is unnecessary and could easily be cut out. Now, an argument could be made that the entire point of this movie is a character finding himself and being around his friends and sort of, you know, learning to relax the stranglehold on his career that he had and just sort of go with the flow a little bit. And that kind of yields better results than when he was trying to control everything. So maybe those scenes do actually add something. But there were a lot of moments where it just felt like, this could be shorter or this doesn't need to be here. I'm fine watching it. Like, it didn't offend me, but it did feel like there were a fair amount of scenes where it was just like, I get it. We can move on now. But anyway,
it didn't bother me. I do know what you mean though. It is more leisurely than many of his other films, I would say. It takes, mm-hmm. it is taking its time. But it feels intentional to me, rather than like an accident. Like he just couldn't shut up, like a Christopher Nolan movie.
Well, the thing about the pacing, though, like when I was watching this earlier, you texted me to see if I was still if I was done yet, and I told you I had a half hour left. But I realized that. We know this sort of like this whole thing is going to culminate in that road trip where he gets to bond with his son and cook and stuff. It's pretty obvious from the beginning that he's going to end up with a food truck. That's a callback from the beginning. He's going to spend time with his kid and okay, they're going to go on the road trip on the way back. But it's literally like the last 30 minutes of the movie. And this is almost a 2-hour movie. The last 30 minutes is that road trip. Like it was taking its time for an hour and a half and then it gets to the meat of it. And I guess that kind of speaks to the ending where everything is wrapped up pretty quickly. I can't imagine. Well, maybe I can't imagine that there's like a 2.5-3 hour long cut of this movie, but it ends rather abruptly when they get back to LA, which is fine. It serves the purpose. It does what it set out to do. But just, you know, the meat of it, like the second and third acts are really kind of condensed into a very short period.
Well, the way I break it down in terms of acts is I think the LA portion is the first act, and then Miami is the second act, and then the third act is the road trip, which culminates in LA as the ending. But the I think that it feels like the road trip is so short because we spend so much time in Miami, with the whole prepping the dilapidated truck stuff, that it makes the rest of it feel like really zippy in comparison.
I don't know. I mean, the prepping the dilapidated truck was even kind of abbreviated, right? They did montage style when they were picking out the new ovens and stuff and the chef knife for the kid. Like, that was a nice moment. But you know, that scene was kind of montagey. Assembling the stuff. He even sends John Favreau away and he'll have the truck up and ready because he's got to make sandwiches for those guys who helped him load the truck. And, you know, there's another moment there where he hangs out with the kid.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is from the start of when they do that until like when they leave Miami, like that portion is almost, I think, as long as the entire road trip.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Maybe it's just that the first act feels like it went really long. Like, the clashing with Dustin Hoffman, I mean, I know there was a lot to set up, but it felt like they could have done it a little more quickly. But I don't know. Who knows? It's just, it's bad. And then, you know, the other thing about the pacing, which I told you briefly over our Slack, is it's, you know, bad thing, bad thing, bad thing. Lots of bad things happen. And he finally lets go of it all. And he goes to Miami. And then, you know, he starts doing good stuff. And then there's no conflict for the rest of the movie. Like, once he decides to finally let go of these things that he is trying to control and he tries to do his own thing and be happy because, you know, how many times does Scarlett Johansson tell him he's not happy? He's not happy. You got to go be happy. Once he finally decides that he can let go and be happy, the conflict is gone. So it's all smooth sailing from there.
Well, there's still some conflict with his kid when even though he has like a handle on the food stuff as they're going on the trip, he still doesn't have a handle on how to interact with his kid. He's still going to just dump him right back where the way things were, that this will only have solved the professional part of his life. It will not have solved his home life. And that goes right up until the very end, where he, you know, sits down and watches the dumb little video the kid made. And the, which I guess is cute or something.
It was cute.
And yeah, with, like, people that love each other. Gah. And, no, but he, you know, he was totally prepared to have his relationship with his son just be taking his son to go to movies, taking his son to go on a roller coaster, taking his son to go do things, taking his son to get kettle corn. That it is, and not spending time talking problem solving like the kid wants. Because what the kid really wants is to have that quality time with his dad. And
right, but that scene slightly early on when the kid actually says, like, I like when we're just sort of hanging out and talking like this, I kind of get the feeling that that sunk in, you know, maybe it sunk in and he didn't immediately know how to act on it. But I thought that was, again, pretty early on when the kid said, you know, I like doing this stuff where we're just hanging out and I'm teaching you what Twitter is all about or whatever it was. But you know, you are right that he kind of is still okay with that being his relationship when they get back, because they have that talk on top of the food truck while they're watching the band, and he's saying, you know, this was a fun summer and all, but it's going to be over soon and it's going to go back to the way it was, and which, you know, the watching his little video makes him say, you know what, even when we get back to LA, I don't have to abide by anybody's rules. We're going to do our own thing. We're going to do whatever we want, which means my kid is going to be with me in the truck, which apparently also means Sofia Vergara is going to be with him in the truck, and then they're going to be happy making good food and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, the scene on top of the truck there was a good emotional moment, and I thought it worked for what it was supposed to do. You know, it shows this, there's still some unresolved stuff between him and his kid. But I did take issue with the, he says, you know, we had a lot of fun this summer. And then the actual words he used were, I really got to know you this, on this trip. And I was like, really? Cause it seemed a lot like you were just kind of hanging out in the truck with the kid and, just driving around making sandwiches. It didn't seem like there was a ton of get to know you time with the kid, but maybe that's just sort of glossed over in the montages.
Well, no, I think he got to know him. I mean, he grew to appreciate the way his kid interacts with the world around him. That's for sure.
Right. He totally really digs the way the kid sort of like kicked off the social media thing in New Orleans and really kind of got everything going for him. And he gains a lot of respect for his kid right there and admiration. But in terms of the get to know you stuff, like what's your kid into and that kind of stuff, I don't know. Maybe I missed some of that.
Well, I don't think that it was explicitly stated. Like, they didn't have a scene where they talked about their likes and dislikes.
That would have been riveting cinema.
No, I'm fine with them glossing over that. I'm willing to say that it was in the in-between scenes, because obviously this is very compressed with the montages of traveling and whatnot.
And yeah, it's 2 hours.
Well, an hour and 40 minutes. So, you know, it's not that bad.
Hour and 54 by IMDb.
Whatever. It's at hour 40 on the Netflix thingy. Whatever. It doesn't matter. It just...
Yes, I know.
Yeah, I'm just saying I don't completely agree with your issue that it's too long. I agree with other things that, you know, it could be tighter. Like, it could be tighter, but I think it would also be a different movie. I think this is very much a feel-good, leisurely pace, like, everything's going to be all right in the end kind of movie. From the very outset of this movie, I had that feeling about this movie, and it delivered on all fronts for that. At no point did I think everything would fall back apart for him. It didn't seem like it was going to be that kind of an ending. Although I get the sense that you were kind of yearning for that, yearning for some additional conflict to arise.
I mean, just something for them to overcome, kind of in the second act, beginning of the third, somewhere in there. It's just, it seemed like there could have been some opportunity for that. And like, you know, the biggest issue he had was like the beach cop telling him to move a quarter mile down the road and then wanting to take a bunch of awkward selfies, which again, I think is one of those kind of riffing moments that went on a little bit long, but it was funny.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of those things where the fact that it went on long is what makes us relate to Favreau's character expressing that it went on too long, because you can see he's very begrudging in his willingness to keep doing these things. But
I don't know how begrudging it really is if he ends up actually doing that Lady and the Tramp picture where they're both chewing on two sides of the bread. It's like, really, guy? That's what you want to do? You want to? No, let's not do that.
No, but he was like rolling his eyes and stuff. Anyway,
yeah, but he still did it.
Okay, what was he supposed to do? Like start a fight with the cop?
Just politely decline, maybe, because you know the cop has already told him like move down the road. Did he think he was gonna somehow take this magical photo or like be real nice to the cop and the cop's gonna be like, all right, maybe you can stay? Like that didn't happen.
No, but all these people could take photos or videos or something of him blowing up at a cop.
No, I'm not saying he needs to blow up. He just needs to be like, I'm not gonna bite a piece of bread with you.
Okay, well, this is why he runs a successful food truck and you don't, Dan. That's all I'm saying.
So are you saying that you and I should bite both sides of a piece of bread in order to make this podcast successful?
Well, I can't hurt. But the... but you know, I guess I can see your point that, you know, towards the end, it is in a way smooth sailing that once they clear New Orleans, there's virtually no conflict at all. There's just the moment of tension over what things will be like when they get back to LA. And that's between him and his son. And then there's a very quiet montage where they're not actually talking to each other through the rest of the states that they're driving through, and they go back to LA and go their separate ways. So you know, it could have had like some other thing in there, but I wouldn't want it to be like, oh, the truck breaks down in Phoenix, uh-oh.
that sounds miserable for everyone.
Yeah, I guess we gotta make some sandwiches on the spot so we can get the truck serviced. That would, like, I mean, we don't need a bake sale every time they roll into town.
No, that's fine. Yeah. You know, that's another thing. There was, you know, a couple other like close-up shots of how much money they were making, mm-hmm. and they never even really discussed the success of the truck itself. I mean, it seemed popular, but you know, who knows how quickly they were burning through their expensive ingredients. Like that was never brought up, and I think that was probably intentional on the point of this being this entire trip being for the purposes of creative expression and having some fun and just going on a road trip. It didn't really matter if this was a successful business venture just yet. He was willing to sort of bite the bullet for a while, so I thought that was okay. But it never did come around to like, hooray, I can pay my bills because this food truck is working now.
This isn't a movie about bookkeeping, Dan. This is a movie about being a chef.
He says he can't go to Miami with him because he doesn't have any money.
This isn't called The Bookkeeper. This is called Chef. This isn't brought to you by Mint.
They should have called it Cuban Sandwich Chef.
Well, see, this is my big contention, as I alluded to earlier on. Cuban sandwiches are all about the bread. Now, obviously, when they're in South Beach, they have access to tons of Cuban bread. A plethora of pans, as it were, because, you know, that's the Spanish word for it. Anyway, so they have tons of bread. But then when they go travel outside of Florida, they no longer have access to Cuban bread. When they go to New Orleans, John Leguizamo's character even, like, picks out the kind of bread. I can't remember the name of it. But in New Orleans, there's a certain famous bakery that makes these special sandwich loaves that they use for po'boys and stuff. And they're like, oh, we got this bread to use for our sandwiches, and we'll mix it up a little. And it's like, no. The whole point of your thing was that you were going to make Cuban sandwiches, and you were going to make the best Cuban sandwiches you can make. And you can't do that now because you don't have freaking Cuban bread, you jerks. And then they go to Texas, and still no Cuban bread. But hey, we're going to make We're going to make sliders with barbecue.
And then, maybe they stocked up on some Cuban bread before they left, and this is a relatively short time span, so it lasted for a little while. But, you know, they did localize. When they went to Texas, they made a brisket modification of their sandwich, which could be okay, right?
No, Dan, Cuban bread does not last. It is one day, because they use lard in it instead of butter.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Bet you didn't know that.
No, I did not.
Yes, it is one of the things that limits its traveling capability. Is that it's good for one day.
Is it possible that they could have been baking their own bread on the food truck?
I don't think so.
We definitely didn't see them do that.
No, we didn't.
Maybe they were just really banking on the fact that the audience wouldn't know that Cuban bread is a special thing.
Yeah, well, they didn't ever talk about it, so I'm going to guess they didn't care.
I didn't know.
Yeah, well, now you know, and knowing's half the battle. CGI Joe.
If I have to go all the way to Florida to get an actual Cuban sandwich with Cuban bread, maybe I'm better off not knowing.
Yeah, well, on the other hand, you go to Florida and you have an actual Cuban sandwich with Cuban bread, and you're just like, that's it.
It's so good though. Wake the kid up and give it to him, and then, you know, of course, Sofia Vergara is like, yeah, yours are better.
Yeah, well, she lied. Because he doesn't care, because he's using the wrong bread. But they get back to L.A., and I guess they could make the point that maybe they went to Portos and they stocked up on Cuban bread from Portos, but it's not going to be as good as Cuban bread from L.A., whatever the deal is. Just so long as they're not using ciabattas. And they make their stuff there, and they do this for, like, I don't know how many nights before Oliver Platt shows back up. And Oliver Platt's all like, they have their scene of burying the hatchet, which is suitably awkward.
A relatively adult conversation, though, of all things. You know, the way Oliver Platt says, like, you came after me. I thought we were, like, it was theater. Like, it was a thing. Like, maybe you actually wanted to have a Twitter feud. Like, I thought that was a surprisingly modern conversation where he's like, I don't know you, dude. Maybe you really wanted to do that. And I was just fighting back. That's just what happens sometimes.
Yeah. I would have been less inclined to have assumed that he wasn't just angry after the whole, like, crushing a cake in his hand in front of my face thing. But the whole thing here is, you know, and he's like, well, I'm not going to review you, so don't worry about it, because I can't review anything I can invest that I want to invest in, and I want to invest in what you do.
Bad guy from the first act now wants to be the good guy at the end who brings all his money to save everything.
Yeah, yeah, and then the kid slaps his hand.
Because he's trying to eat like a prawn or something off of some buffet platter.
Yeah, which is funny, though, because he slaps his hand, but the hand actually gets pushed down into the food because he slapped it. So it was not an incredibly effective deterrent. But this is all, you know, just icing on the sandwich for the wedding renewal vow thing, ceremony thing at the very end, that they're back together, which is curious that they chose to go that route.
Yeah, Sofia Vergara falls back in love with him because he's finally following his passion, and he's happy again, and he's spending time with the kid, and she has that fun phone call where she says, oh, no, I'll fly out and I'll come pick up the kid. You know, he doesn't need to be on the road trip any longer, and you can tell she's really just sad that she's missing out on all the fun because she's looking at the Facebook updates, and she blurts out that she loves him too, even though she kind of hides it and pretends it's for the kid, and she's happy. Hooray, she's happy that Jon Favreau is back on his game. They fall back in love and get remarried, which is odd, but yeah. It happens.
Well, you know, I guess it's a way to end a movie. But the one thing in here, though, that we missed out on is when they were in Miami and Robert Downey Jr. Very not subtly implies that they could have potentially had sex after the divorce between John Favreau's character of Carl Casper and Inez, that, you know, he could have been in LA and they could have done something. And so Carl gets very defensive about this and brings it up with Inez, which is total BS. I feel like every time I see some guy acting all macho about the fact that he's had that his ex-wife has had some affair or something. Meanwhile, he's been running around with Molly, the front of house like the hostess. It is incredibly insulting. I don't understand why that even needed to be written that way.
She's just a waitress, and Sophia is somebody he sees all the time, and his ex-wife that they had a very long and important relationship or something. I don't know. The Robert Downey Jr. scene is another one that kind of went on a little bit long, and maybe they could have toned some of that down if there was a little less silliness and playing around in that scene. But interestingly, I don't know. You probably haven't seen the movie because it's not a great movie, but it struck me that Robert Downey Jr. in this movie is playing the exact same character that Jamie Foxx played in his movie Due Date, if you ever saw it, with Galifianakis.
Nope, didn't see it.
Literally verbatim, basically the same storyline, brief moment where he has to, you know, ask him for help, and you know, they're friends or something, or just they're intertwined in each other's life, and there's that awkward tension where he has all the photos of his ex-wife in there, and it's just like, oh, that's weird, but it turns out to be nothing.
Yeah, well, fortunately Molly has a heart of gold and thinks he should get his life in order, and that's how she feels about things at the beginning of the movie, and that's what sets him off on his little path, and then he gets back together with his actual wife and everything's fine. And that just bugged me a little bit.
She wasn't even invited to the wedding party yet, El Jefe, was she?
No, well, I wouldn't have invited her.
Well, they're friends. Mm-hmm. She's kind of responsible for, you know, telling him to go be happy.
Yeah, except, you know, she had also stuffed him, so...
Well, it's implied. We know she has enjoyed his pasta.
Oh yeah, that's not a euphemism for anything. His garlic and parsley pasta.
I know a lot of this is about the cooking of the food, and there were a lot of nice like macro shots of like the actual slicing and the preparation of the meal, but I did feel like some of that was a little excessive, like the incredibly slow slicing of the beef, and you know, just the assembling of the meals. It was just like really drawn out.
I think the words you're looking for are food porn.
Yeah, but like food porn in slow motion.
Yes. Well, that's pretty much what food porn is. The slower the better.
Sure. It's fine to look at. It just makes me hungry, and then it makes me sad because there aren't a whole lot of nice places I can just run out and get some food around here.
Yeah, well, food porn has that effect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Although you could just cruise on down to wherever his restaurant was supposed to be and just get some good food yourself.
Yeah. Yes. Let me go to the imaginary restaurant from this movie and have an imaginary chocolate lava cake.
See, if they were if they were smart, they would open a restaurant called El Jefe in wherever that was supposed to be, and cash in on people being curious about whether or not the food is actually good.
I'm sure it was some Venice rat hole. Some converted house with a backyard, and oh, look at us, aren't we so trendy and bohemian. Disgusting.
I love those bars and restaurants in sort of South Santa Monica, Venice area, where it's just like, it's an old house where they like crowbarred a bar into the corner, and it's like the worst possible setup where you can't like you can't even get close to getting a drink at a place like that.
Mm-hmm. The poor bar UX.
Yes, there is very poor bar UX, although the mm-hmm. restaurants seem to have very nice bar UX at the end there. There were chalkboards everywhere that said congratulations, and there were large tables and lights and things.
Mm-hmm.
And a patio.
That's because it needed to be all trendy and handmade and wholesome and everything. You know, so it does contrast very nicely with the sort of sterile newness of the restaurant at the beginning of the film. That it is, you know, this put together like haphazard kind of thing, where it's the fun and it's trendy and creative and yay, jerks.
We're all just artists here making food and apparently just following your artistic desires and your creative roots is the way to become rich and famous.
Yeah,
and never have anything bad happen to you ever again.
Well. It's not a realistic movie, Dan.
no like, crap.
I don't know why you're so hard on it. Like, oh, he followed his bliss, that jerk.
no, I'm not saying. No, don't get me wrong. Like, compared to most people, I am that guy where I'm like, I'm not going to have a regular job and listen to other people. I'm just going to do what I want. But like, watching him go like, oh, I'm finally going to do that thing that I've been wanting to do my whole life, and everyone has finally talked me into it, and then every single good thing I have ever wanted is finally happening, and all I had to do was follow my bliss, and it's like, oh, please, come on. But it's a movie. It doesn't have to be realistic. It's a nice feel-good thing. It ends in the best possible way, in the best possible circumstances for Mr. Favreau, and that's fine. It's a movie.
You're just sad because we didn't put you on a director truck and send you across the country directing films in every town.
Come on down to hashtag South Beach and I'll direct your selfies or something.
you could direct their hyperlapses. You could direct their vines.
Sure, I could do that.
You could explain, you know, like, we need some high-key lighting here, so I'm going to bring in my lighting rig. You know, you could do all that stuff.
I should have a kid and then make him my DP, and he can follow me around lighting things.
Mm-hmm.
And then he can burn his finger at some point. I can say, are you good? Are you okay? You want to keep going? Want to take a break?
And then he could try to serve someone a poorly cut together piece of film, and then you could take him out back.
And we could teach him the lesson about we don't do this just to do it. We do this because we care about it. And we love it. And if you do this long enough, I think you could love it too. But we don't serve burnt edits to people. I've never burned an edit. I've never edited film. You left your film on the optical printer too long and we burned it. We don't show that in theaters to people.
What if the back of the truck was just a dark room and you had chemical boxes and they're just sloshing around while you're driving through the town and you're developing film?
Oh, my son got developer in his eyes.
That all sounds terrible, Dan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then in the end, you finally make it back to Phoenix and you reconcile with your estranged wife. And you live the dream, making films in your house with little lopsided pendant lights. So it'll be great.
No, that's not the dream.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever had a dream wherein I was actually in Phoenix, even when I live in Phoenix.
Oh, are you saying it is not worthy of your aspirations?
No, like, what is there to aspire to? I'm here. Like, it's not hard.
You could live somewhere nice, like Scottsdale or something.
See, I know you're from out of town, so you have this illusion that Scottsdale is nicer than the rest of the place. It's all the same.
No, I've been there. Remember? I drove through it. It all looks relatively the same. There are different beige houses of varying sizes and years of construction arranged on very wide lots and very wide streets, and everything's very far apart from everything else. So, yeah. But you could have a nice McMansion. Your $1,200 electrical bill from air conditioning, it would be great.
that would be a problem.
Mm-hmm. But you'd be directing things so well that it wouldn't be a problem. You'd be directing your what would be the version of a Cuban? Oh, you could be directing your German expressionist shorts.
No. How about this? How about I get a film food truck and I drive around and people will bring their food to me, or I can go to the restaurant where they're having lunch and I will direct their Vines and or Instagram photos of their food.
Oh, that is perfect. And then so everybody has an authentic Dan Sturm food.
Right.
Blog.
They can Instagram it with hashtag directed by Dan.
Mm-hmm. That'll be great.
Is there a city hipster and small enough where I could actually make this a business? I'm thinking maybe Portland, where I could go around downtown Portland and direct people's Instagram photos of their meal.
It sounds like a Portlandia sketch, more than an actual Portland thing. You should pitch that to Fred Armisen and see if you can get that ball rolling.
Let's take this conversation offline in case I actually want to use this idea for something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because this is
like ending
gold.
My career. I could use this idea to end my career.
Well, you can always meet up with Gordon Ramsay and film his food.
And then I can blow up at him because he doesn't understand my art.
Yes.
You think it's easy to direct these iPhones where I'm pointing them at food?
Yeah, you think you're getting to me?
Or I bring a bounce light?
You think you're not getting to me?
You're not getting to me. I got my own iPhone. I can direct my own stuff. Anyway, back to Chef, not my my spinoff Portlandia sketch director.
Mm-hmm. All of the things.
What do you think?
Of the film? I liked it.
Of the film, yes.
I don't know. We we went abroad there for a moment. I liked the film. I'm not going to ever buy this or own this or get a collector's edition that is signed or anything, or purchase any memorabilia from the film. But
it's on Netflix. That's all you need. But I mean, what about, like, if there was an actual El Jefe restaurant, would you go down and buy a sandwich as the portion of memorabilia that you could just eat and then say, oh, that was a good memento from the film, and I don't have to keep it on a bookshelf in my office?
You don't eat memorabilia, Dan. That's not how that works.
Who's to say you can't?
Memorabiliaists, I'm sure, would be offended, and foodies would be upset, and there'd be just chaos. Cats and dogs
I'm pretty sure foodies are upset about literally anything you ever say about them.
Yes, I am 100% sure. Have you ever read the comments on any of the things on Eater? Just go, just any Eater thing at random that has a comment on it, and just go and read it, and it's someone being angry about something.
I am not in the least bit surprised. I looked up the comments on some restaurant that we like around here on Yelp, and I saw this one guy had this really negative review, unsurprisingly, and I clicked on him, and he had like 11,000 reviews, and I think literally every one of them was like, this is the worst place I have ever been. He reviewed Costco. Like, this is the worst Costco I have ever been to. I just came in here for a quick bite for lunch, and they were incredibly rude. It's like, whoa, back up. You're reviewing all these restaurants, and you eat lunch at Costco? Anyway, I'm going to dismiss everything you've ever said.
Well, that is a huge problem with Yelp, is that it is a theater for people to see your dislike of things. Very much unlike our podcast.
We like Cuban sandwiches.
Yeah.
Even though there aren't any real ones around here, apparently.
We like Cuban sandwiches and the movie Chef. But with Yelp, it is a platform for people to get noticed, and that they notice that people get a lot of attention for being negative. And being negative is not the same thing as critiquing something. They're different. So they'll just go on these long diatribes about how this isn't real, whatever it is, and blah, 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 blah. Like, some schmuck could just go on there and say, this isn't a real Cuban sandwich. It doesn't have real Cuban bread! Exclamation mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark. These people are lazy. Like, how dare they even call this a Cubano sandwich with this pork loin? Dry pork sandwich is more like it! Exclamation mark. You know, just some jerk could do that.
Are you just reading out of your Yelp right now?
And just trying to remember all the things I said at the beginning of the episode. but that's why I mostly find Yelp to be, in a general sense, useless in terms of actual words people commit to it. I will click on photos and stuff that are on there, because then it's like, well, it's a picture of food, so I can tell at least sort of what it looks like from there, since I'm pretty sure that you can't do a decent job of describing anything you're eating. None of you are paid to write about food, so you don't understand it. So that's fine. I don't have to read it. It's okay.
But technology can bring people closer together. It can help a burgeoning business, whether it's a food truck driving cross country or a fussy restaurant in Hollywood. And it can even bring a family together in the form of a montage of 1 second clips shot over the span of multiple weeks. Is the lesson from this film.
Well, the montage video, just a little tiny bone to pick. It seemed like a couple of the moments that they picked, because it's supposed to be 1 second from each day. It seemed like a couple of them were 1 second from the same day.
The bone I was going to pick is that a couple of the shots included the kid and everyone else. So it was who was shooting these? Because they're still like handheld.
Yeah, but I thought he was just doing like a selfie thing.
No. There's one or two shots where, like, the kid is making sandwiches, and you can see them all doing their thing, making sandwiches. So it's, like, shot from the driver's seat of the truck, and they're all in the back of the truck making food. It's like, that's... Who's doing that one? Maybe it was the cop.
Yeah. They got one of their fans. I don't know. At least nobody had a dream where they were seeing things that were shot in the third person or something like that. That always bugs me. but that is the end of the film. And oh wait, I said I liked it, but I didn't want to like commemorate it or anything. What were your feelings on it? Because I know that you seemed sort of neutral to dismissive about this.
I would say neutral. It was a well-made film. It was enjoyable to watch. I liked the food. It's a bummer that most of the like crazy, weird, adventurous food was in the beginning, and it was just Cuban sandwiches all the way down after the second act. But it looked good. I want a Cuban sandwich now. I might go seek one out in Chandler. It's probably the closest Cuban restaurant to me. But yeah, it was... I don't regret that I watched the movie, but yeah, I'm probably not going to go buy a chef t-shirt or something. So
I'm willing to bet that the Cuban sandwich that you'll find in Phoenix, Arizona is not actually very good.
I've had it before.
Okay, well, see, exactly. So it's fine. So then it's not good. So well, don't eat it.
Compared to no Cuban sandwich, the Cuban sandwich that I get in Chandler is actually pretty good.
Oh, okay. So it's better than nothing.
It's a really high bar to reach.
It's a sandwich. Shrug.
I want a Cuban sandwich. Here are my options. Not a Cuban sandwich or a Cuban sandwich from Chandler.
Okay, fine. I was going to say, whenever I, you know, feel like having Cuban food, rather than face the inevitable disappointment and slide into the depression that a Cuban sandwich in Los Angeles gives me, I can just have ropa vieja from several establishments that can put that together. Have you ever had ropa vieja?
I don't know what that is.
It is shredded beef in a lovely sauce, and it is served with rice and beans, and sometimes platanos, or you can get it with tostones, or whatever you want. And it is delicious. If you happen to like shredded beef with a delicious sauce, then I don't see why you wouldn't.
In all honesty, that sounds pretty similar to what I had at this Cuban restaurant last time. I think Amanda had the Cuban sandwich, and I just ate half of it.
Oh, okay.
Because that's how I roll.
You just eat half a sandwich?
I eat half of her sandwich and most of my food.
Is that a euphemism?
No. Oh. Which is why I probably gained a little bit of weight since the last time you saw me, but I'm actually down since last week.
I never saw you before.
That was a quote from the movie.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
Remember that scene that went on too long?
Yeah. Yeah. I thought you were talking about yourself, and I was like, Dan, geez, get a grip.
No. My weight is generally pretty constant, no matter how many Cuban sandwiches I eat, which is pretty much zero.
That's a great fact.
Yeah, yes. So next time somebody asks you, how rapidly does Dan's weight fluctuate? You can be like, it really doesn't fluctuate all that often, and I know this because I asked him.
Yes, because we talked about how many Cuban sandwiches he eats.
The rate of Cuban sandwiches charted on a graph versus his weight is actually pretty constant.
Cuban sandwiches per Dan.
It's a natural fact that I wanna come back.